From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn more about an analysis of Milwaukee police records that shows racial disparities and lack of probable cause in who is stopped by police in the city.
Then, an exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum explores the ancient Mayan civilization of Central America. They had a pretty sophisticated understanding of astronomy, even if they didn't exactly use it to further scientific knowledge.
Their goal was not to understand the universe and how it worked. Their goal was to explain their own mythology of how the world was created and why, and so they saw it all as tied up with religion.
But centuries later, the Hubble telescope has definitely advanced our understanding of our world and the universe.
It's been confirmed to death. The universe is accelerating in its expansion, and of course you know where this is going. We don't know why that is.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. The American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin just released an in-depth analysis of records from the Milwaukee Police Department. It found a pattern of problems with how stops are being conducted. Outside experts found that nearly half of the vehicular stops they analyzed failed to cite a probable cause. For pedestrian stops, it was nearly 60%.
The report also found major racial discrepancies in who is being stopped. The majority of stops were made in Black and Latino neighborhoods, but even in predominantly white neighborhoods, Black and Latino people were more likely to be stopped.
The records were analyzed as part of a class action lawsuit against MPD. The ACLU is representing 9 plaintiffs in the case, but they said their experiences are representative of many Milwaukee residents. I had a chance to sit down with a lawyer from the ACLU of Wisconsin to talk about their case Collins v. City of Milwaukee and the findings of this report.
As part of the legal process, when you file a case like this, and it's a class action lawsuit, one of the things you do if you're showing a systemic practice is you have to get data and then you have to analyze the data. You can't just bring a lawsuit or proceed with the lawsuit on hunch. You have to actually analyze the data. So most of the data was, for example, records and databases that were turned over by the Milwaukee Police Department as part of what's called the discovery process to us. And then we obtained people with expertise in several different but overlapping fields to analyze that data.
So on the point of their stop records, one of the things that has come up in the reporting on this report is that the Milwaukee Police Department, they don't have, they say they don't have an official stop and frisk program. And it's unclear to me the kinds of records they're requiring of police when they are stopping people.
They are required when they conduct a traffic stop. There actually is a database in which they enter data. Generally, I believe the name of the person, race, and a number of other factors, reason for the stop, things like that. There's a separate system where they enter data for pedestrian stops. So two things come out of that. One was a lot of evidence of racial disparities in who was being stopped. And then separately, hundreds of thousands of entries from both of those databases were missing the kind of information that would show there was a legal or constitutional justification for the stop in the first place. So you have data that both shows disparities in race of who's being stopped and that shows fairly widespread lack of information that there was that there was a legal justification for those stops.
What would legal justification for stops really look like?
The standard is called reasonable suspicion. So it's less than what people hear probable cause to arrest someone, but you can have reasonable suspicion that some kind of criminal behavior or other kind of violation is occurring.
Can you give me an example of what something like that might be? Say I'm walking down the street, a police officer sees me. What might I be doing that would be reasonable for them to stop me?
Let me flip it around. Say it in reverse. You're walking down the street at night and it's dark and you're walking past a number of stores that are closed. That would not be reasonable for someone to stop you. You are, one of our clients is, walking home late at night from UWM where you're a student, and the bicycle police pass you and then turn around and stop you and ask you what you're doing there and something about whether you're smoking marijuana or things like that. Those aren't the exact words, that's a paraphrase, but you are an 11-year-old child, as was one of our plaintiffs, who is going over to his friend's house, and as he gets there, is both on his phone calling and knocking on the door or ringing the doorbell, I don't recall which, but the police come up and ask you what you're doing there, and then also go ahead and search your backpack. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons that those people are being stopped, there really isn't a good reason except that you're someone walking where an officer thinks you shouldn't be. I mean, that's what a lot of these end up appearing to be.
So it's really it seems at least, the discretion of these officers. Who do you think should be in this area?
Who do you think? I mean, someone being in the wrong area, that's like overly broad discretion. One of the factors that's in their materials talks about like time of day or night. Again, what does that mean? The example, you know, we heard a couple of times was someone in an industrial area with no residential areas at night after buildings close. Okay, maybe that's appropriate, but that's not most of what's going on either. The well-known phenomenon of race out of place. So a person of color in a predominantly white neighborhood or a white person in a central city neighborhood, that shouldn't be enough to justify a stop. Those are all examples of the kinds of things that we're concerned about. And let me just say, with respect to race out of place, one of the findings in this report is Black and Latino people are more likely than white people to be subject to traffic stops across Milwaukee, including in police districts where the residents are primarily white. So that includes District 1, which is the east side and downtown, and District 6, which is more sort of southwest, west side, which is, again, a primarily white district. There's a lot of racial disproportion in those districts as well.
Well, and to get into the numbers a little bit, you guys analyzed more than 350,000 records. Of those records, it seemed that almost 50%, 48% of traffic stops, they didn't really provide a legal reason for stopping people. When it came to pedestrian stops, the number was much higher at 59%. But what do the numbers bear out when we look at race?
There were 300 records of more than 350,000 stops showing lack justification. So actually the analysis was of a lot more records than that. But again, the critical findings are that huge numbers and huge percentages of stops, or at least the records of those stops, are not showing the legal justification for the stop, and that the records are showing that the people stopped are disproportionately Black and Latino across the city, again, even in predominantly white districts.
When we say disproportionately, what is the actual number there for most neighborhoods?
Well, it varies. So in districts 1 and 6, Black and Latino people experienced traffic stops that were more than 6 times the white stop rate in district 1 and more than 3 times the white stop rate in district 6. So it's a lot.
Yeah.
And again, let me just throw out one other thing. One of the things that was said to us is, well, district 1 includes downtown, and there aren't a lot of people of color who live in District 1, there are a lot of them downtown. That's something we hear. And I just want to flag that there are also a lot of white people who don't live in District 1 who spend time downtown, including a lot of people who don't live in Milwaukee at all. And the District 1 disparities in particular were also addressed by or recognized by the U.S. Department of Justice in the COPS report. They said the same thing.
How has MPD defended its program so far? How has it been defending its policy?
We have heard the former chief say, there is no stop and frisk policy, to which, again, we respond, well, you don't have to call it stop and frisk for that to be what's occurring. It is often defended on the grounds or as an assertion that it's a crime-fighting technique. It appears that the MPD itself has recognized for sure that stopping lots of pedestrians doesn't deter crime. And we don't see how stopping lots of people who haven't done anything wrong for busted taillights or, you know, very minor violations, or again, as our expert reports are showing, often for no evident reason at all. What it does is it stops a lot of innocent people and results in a lot of community alienation. And one of the findings in the COPS report by the Department of Justice that we think is important was talking about that alienation of the community from the police department, that there wasn't, even though the words community policing were used, the community didn't feel like that was what was occurring.
Well, and it seems like, according to your the analysis that you just released, the stops of both Black and Latino residents resulted in far fewer incidents of criminality.
A very small percentage of people were searched at all. So, and then of those people searched, an even tinier amount were found with anything serious, such as guns or drugs. So those traffic stop searches of Black and Latino drivers were less likely to lead to the discovery of drugs than traffic stop searches of white drivers, for example. And, you know, much less of anything more serious. And so not only is that indicating some racial disparities here, but it's also calling into question the purpose of all these stops to begin with. At least, you know, that's what it appears.
If we can put this into a national perspective, of course, stop and frisk policies have made headlines for years, really.
Right.
But how does Milwaukee compare to other comparable cities? Do we know?
We haven't done, you know, a full-scale city-by-city analysis. This was, I would say, a pretty aggressive program of stopping people. I mean, if you go back and look at the data between 2007 and then 2008, 2009, it's a steep upward trend in stops. It happened very quickly. There were both traffic and pedestrian stops, very high numbers of stops, going from relatively low numbers of stops to very high numbers of stops. We do know, I mean, the most noted example of stop and frisk is New York City Police Department, which did that for years, which got sued over it, which ended up settling the lawsuit by eliminating its stop and frisk program. When that happened, there was a lot of public concern raised, at least among some people, that crime was going to increase, that this was, you know, that stop and frisk had somehow deterred crime and crime was going to increase. And yet when New York stopped its stop and frisk program, crime has continued to decline. So you asked a question earlier about some of the reasons for it. If the police department is saying, we need stop and frisk, or however it's called, we need all these stops to deter crime, take a look at what happened in New York. They were able to reduce crime without that kind of a program. And we think that's really important as well.
Karen Rotker is a senior staff attorney at the ACLU. Well, the WUWM newsroom has been following this story as well, and news director Annalise Henzel is here now with more. Good morning, Annalise.
Hey, Bonnie.
Talk about some of the reaction that the ACLU is getting to these numbers.
Sure. Well, we reached out to the Milwaukee Police Department and the mayor's office, two places that I think are pretty automatic in a story like this. Both declined the chance to talk about the figures. But we did find someone else whose opinion we wanted to hear. That was criminal justice expert Stan Stojkovic. He's at UWM, and he's the dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, and he keeps an eye on policing issues around the country. We asked Stojkovic about the ACLU figure, and he said that number, 350,000 unwarranted stops, that's a higher number than what he is accustomed to hearing. However, he says in general, when it comes to the demographics of the stops, while he considers the numbers sad, he says they're not out of the ordinary.
This is not unusual in large urban centers where you have police departments under the siege and also under the pressure of local officials who are trying to get them to address crime problems and be a little bit more aggressive in their pursuits and in how they do their police work. And this kind of stuff's going to happen.
When Stojkovic is talking about the pressure from elected officials, he gave an example from the tenure of former police chief Edward Flynn, who, as you know, just stepped down last week. He retired. Stojkovic said Flynn had a, quote, rational and reasonable policy that was in place to limit hot pursuits in cases where the danger of a police chase outweighed the risk of the people who were running away from police. But aldermen complained loudly about that policy, and ultimately Flynn was forced to change the policy to be more aggressive against his wishes. Stojkovic says that's the kind of pressure that chiefs around the country are under. Now, he adds that the realities of policing in a large city like Milwaukee, including with that pressure from aldermen, doesn't justify any illegal or inappropriate stops or searches that police may have done. He says he'll be eager to find out the outcome of analysis of these figures from the ACLU to determine whether the numbers are valid.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to find that out. What other voices did you want to include in your story?
Well, we did want to hear from former Chief Flynn because he commented often about police pursuit policies and about police traffic stops. It's something that he was asked about frequently, and many people complained about his policies. He always defended those policies, and he defended a data-driven approach to policing, saying that he put the police on the street where the crime statistics warranted the police presence there. Flynn said if numbers at the ACLU or any other organization would turn up, showed a disproportionate representation of residents being pulled over based on the demographics, it was a reflection of the places where police are patrolling. And in this case, in Milwaukee, many of the most high crime areas happen to be the largely African-American neighborhoods. And Flynn always would point out that the areas where there's a lot of crime are areas where residents are demanding police services. He thought it was counterproductive for people to complain in general about police when these types of numbers came up. And we found a quote of his from a news conference that was held this time last year after the ACLU first announced this class action lawsuit regarding the so-called stop and frisk policies of police.
The conversation I'd rather have with the ACLU is, okay, guys, you're right. There is a disparate impact of police engagement trying to reduce crime. And there is a gross disparate impact on victimization by crime. I think last time we looked, African Americans were 15 times more likely to get shot than white folks. Okay? That's crazy. No one should have to live like that. So how do we join those conversations?
Whoever Flynn's successor is going to have an interesting time of it, aren't they?
That's for sure.
Well, this isn't the only big criminal justice item that you're reporting on. There's another big story breaking.
Yes, that's true. We are following the story of more charges that are related to the dehydration death of Terrell Thomas. He was the inmate who died about 2 years ago at the Milwaukee County Jail. He was a man who had, was it bipolar disorder? I'm sorry, let me think. I guess you're going to have to edit this. He was a man with mental illness, and jail guards claimed that he was causing a lot of problems, including stuffing materials down the toilet and causing his cell to flood. So they said that they shut off the water to prevent him from flooding the cell, and that the water was supposed to have been turned back on again after his behavior improved. However, the water never was turned back on again, and he died of dehydration after being in the jail for about a week. You may recall last week, criminal charges, felony charges, were handed down against three of the former jail staff who were county employees. The latest charges that came out just yesterday from the DA's office involve the company that runs the medical services at the jail. It's called Armour Correctional Health Services, and it is accused of falsifying the records of the inmates. For instance, Armour Correctional workers are accused of recording that they had checked on Thomas during the time that he was an inmate there, and they did things like do his blood pressure readings and pulse rate checks, and that everything was fine, when in reality, surveillance video shows that they avoided his cell completely in some cases or walked by and didn't even stop. So now Armour Correctional is facing 7 misdemeanor counts of intentionally falsifying health records at the jail. Now, Armour Correctional says it has not had the chance to review those allegations yet, but it will vigorously defend any claims brought against it.
So you'll be reporting on this as more comes to light.
Yes, we will.
All right. Annalise Hensel, thank you so much for stopping by this morning. There will be more coverage, of course, also on our website at WUWM.com.
Anytime, Bonnie.
Annalise Hensel is WUWM's news director.
Coming up after a break, the world of the ancient Maya comes to life at the Milwaukee Public Museum. We'll visit the exhibit when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. The largest exhibit on the ancient Maya ever to be displayed in the United States is currently on view at the Milwaukee Public Museum. This pre-Columbian civilization flourished in what is now Central America and had advanced mathematics, a written language, and sophisticated art and architecture.
But Carter Lupton, the former curator of ancient history at the Public Museum, says the question this exhibit hopes to answer is not only who were the Maya, but who are they? Because they're still around.
The Maya make up one of the largest groups of native-speaking pre-Columbian American Indians that are still extant. There are several million of them living in the Maya area, which includes the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, all of Guatemala, all of Belize, and portions of Honduras and El Salvador. So it's a fairly large area. The Maya are, as a people, are defined as people who speak a Mayan language, which there are many, many different dialects of Mayan languages. They are part of a larger cultural group called Mesoamericans, which includes Aztecs, Toltecs, Olmecs, groups that are not Maya, but share similar cultural patterns with the Maya. They share things like the same food crops, maize, beans, squash, and chili peppers. They share building monumental architecture and building pyramids as their main temple structures. They share ideas like the ball game, the famous Maya ball game. It's not just the Maya ball game, it's the Mesoamerican ball game. So you'll find that up even in central Mexico, out of the Maya area. So they're just part of this bigger cultural pattern.
You've talked about what is similar that the Maya have in common with these other groups. What makes them distinct?
Well, as I said, what defines them officially is their language. If they speak a Mayan language, of which, as I said, there are many, many dialects, then they are Maya people. Other things that make them different just by chance, for example, archaeologically, is the fact that the Maya actually have a complete written language, which we could not 30 years ago really translate very much of. Now we can translate most of it. So that's one of the big changes that's happened in the last 20, 30 years. If you look at Aztecs, for example, in central Mexico, they have written or pictographic documents, which we call Aztec writing, but it's not really writing. They're not writing verbs and vowels and full sentences and full grammar. They are putting down pictures of things to say, well, we got so much tribute of deer skins, we got so much tribute of this, so they put that with a number by it. That's picture writing, and it's a very simple form of not truly full writing. The Maya have a very fascinating advanced grammar that uses both phonetic and ideographic or meaningful sounds, symbols. So that's one of the big differences, and that's why we've learned so much more about the Maya. We're used to the Aztecs because the Aztecs were here when the Spanish came. I mean, the Maya were here too, but the Maya were no longer living in these complex cities that we see in this exhibit because most of those had been abandoned. But the Maya as a people still existed. The Aztecs were the big power in Mexico at the time, and so that's who the Spanish went out of their way to deal with and conquer, yes. And so we hear a lot about the Aztecs. There are a lot of contemporary reports by Spaniards, whereas there are far fewer contemporary reports about what the Maya were like, who they sort of saw as, I guess, backwater people, you know, just living on the fringes of real civilization.
Do we know what happened, why the Maya abandoned their cities, and mm-hmm. why the complex civilization seemed to simplify?
Well, there's no one single reason, as with so many things, whether it's the demise of the dinosaurs or anything else. There's never one explanation. Several have been proposed over the years, and we're in a period now where generally they look at individual sites and say, what happened at this site? And in some sites, it's collapse of the environment over exploitation, deforestation, erosion, and then, of course, loss of crops. Loss of crops means loss of population, loss of power for the political rulers, can lead to revolts. And when the political rulers are gone, there's nobody to control building massive monuments anymore. So people may stick around as squatters in a site and live in buildings that are already built, but they're not going to be building new ones. Or they may abandon them altogether for greener pastures. So it's a lot of different features and different, there are droughts, of course. So there's natural factors that they can't control and other things that you could call societal problems.
One of the things that I think the Maya are known for now is that they had very complex mathematics, and they also were very good and keen astronomers, were they not?
To a certain degree. I mean, they did very tight observations astronomically. Most of it was not for its own sake. Their goal was not to understand the universe and how it worked. Their goal was to explain their own mythology of how the world was created and why. And so they saw it all as tied up with religion, which most ancient cultures, you couldn't separate science and religion the way we do today. They would see it as some combination of the two. They certainly followed movements of the sun and moon. They also, the Maya, very carefully could calculate and had calculated the movements of Venus, the planet Venus. Not a whole lot else, but they were good mathematicians, as you say. The Maya actually invented, and I don't even know if it's the Maya, the actual numerical system used by the Maya may have been created by one of the other Mesoamerican peoples, like the Olmecs, we think.
And they sort of appropriated
And the Mayas adapted it and borrowed it. But they had, for example, the concept of zero, which had been created in the Arabic numeral system, and I believe one other, but is not a common concept. And without zero, there's not a lot you can do with math, because it's like people ask me all the time, what's the year zero? And I say, there's no year zero. There's a year negative one and there's a year positive one. Year zero wouldn't be a year. It'd be a point in time. So you need a concept of zero as a placeholder between positive numerals and negative numerals.
One of the other things that I think is so interesting about, well, the Maya, but also all of the Mesoamerica peoples, is the kinds of carvings that they did. And it's not just building the temples and those famous tall stairs, you know, they're really hard to go up. But there's these really interesting, very, very detailed, they remind me in some ways of Pictish carvings, like I've seen in Scotland. I mean, that kind of detail. Are these religious? Were they religious figures, or were they notating who the famous people were? Or?
Most of it is historical now. We used to, 30, 40 years ago, they used to say, oh, the Maya are ruled by priest kings, whatever that meant, which was Archelaus' way of saying we don't really know. So they would call them priest kings. Now we know that the carved stela at these various sites, whether it's Copan or Tikal or whatever it happens to be, they depict real individuals, historical people who were their rulers, sometimes the queens of their rulers. It tells their history. It'll give dates of when they were born sometimes, when they became the ruler of that site, what famous battles they may have fought with other sites, whether they won or lost, if they had a child and the child became a king later. All that kind of historical information can now be pulled out of these monuments, which, as they couldn't have been done 3 or 4 decades ago.
For people who are coming into this and might not know much or anything about the Maya civilization or the greater Mesoamerica civilizations, how do you suggest they approach an exhibit like this? What should they be looking for? What should they make sure that they pay attention to?
Well, what's great about this particular exhibit, it is very broad, and it covers almost all major aspects of Maya culture. So it starts out with an introduction about who are the Maya and what do we know about them archaeologically, how we learned about them. There's a whole timeline here that talks about the years that the various discoveries were made. And if you're into that, you can get a history of that fairly quickly. But then it goes into Maya culture itself, and it talks about individual sites. It talks about their accomplishments, whether it's architectural. We have several large-scale replicas, which are impossible to miss. They're the sort of standouts visually of the exhibit.
And these are the stela you were talking about that have the figures.
Various kings, yeah. Yes. For example, there are two here standing side by side, two stela, and 30 years ago or more, I would say, if you looked in a book, they would not know who these individuals were. They'd say that these are both Maya rulers. This one's from a site in Copan in Honduras, and the next one next to it is actually from a site in Guatemala, but it's very close by, the site of Quirigua. But we know today that the king from Honduras is depicted on a stela, and he was a very famous and long-lived king at Copan. The stela next to him, which is actually bigger, is from a smaller site. Quirigua is a much smaller site. But we know that the king from Quirigua is the man who defeated and killed the king of Copan and beheaded him, something we didn't know 30, 40 years ago. So we can put a history to these just like you can to ancient Egypt, for example, which you couldn't do for the Maya back in the mid-20th century.
It must be exciting for someone like you who spent a lifetime trying to learn about these cultures to have that ability now. It's like keys are unlocking things all over the place.
It is. It's a total change in how you look at it. You know, when I was young, I studied Egypt, and Egypt was a culture we knew a lot about because we could read the hieroglyphs. We've been able to read those since the middle of the 19th century. Whereas the Maya were more of a, you knew the culture in general, you knew what they built, but you didn't know much about them as a people. So it was more of an anthropological look you could have, but you couldn't have a historical look. Now you can look at them historically almost in the same detail. You can look at an ancient Egypt or an ancient Greece.
You say there are still people who are Maya, who are living today, even though obviously these civilizations are long gone. Do those people, do you know, have any connection to these sites? Do they honor their heritage in any way?
Yeah, some do. For example, we have, it's not in this exhibit, but in our permanent exhibit up on the third floor, one small group of Maya called the Lacandon. They live very near an ancient Maya city named Palenque in Mexico. Today, if you go to visit Palenque, there's always several Maya, Lacandon Maya, around selling things to tourists that they make and just still living in that general area and following some of the traditions. Many of the Maya in Guatemala in the south, where it's very mountainous and every village is separated from another village by a little mountain valley, live their own style. Some follow old traditions, many of which are discussed here in the exhibit. They make textiles in patterns that are reminiscent of the ancient patterns that we can see from the carvings. They live basically on the same kinds of basic foods.
How much did the Spanish influence the Maya? You say they're pretty much gone as a big major civilization by the time the Spanish arrived.
Yeah.
Did the Spanish, European, and Catholicism have any real effect on the Maya the way they did on the Aztec?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Catholicism is still the nominal religion of most Maya. You know, they'll say they're Catholic, and then they have churches in their villages, and they go to Catholic Mass and that. But as I say, they still also perform some of their rituals, whether it's rituals to ask for the rain to come and grow the corn, things like that. But they're always somewhat of a blending. You know, they'll take, for example, in Catholic practice, there is some parts of the world where incense is still burned in the church. Well, burning incense is a very typical Maya thing. So to them, it's not adapting it so much. It's just taking something they already do and seeing it in a little different context than it was before.
Well, Carter Lupton, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to meet me.
You're welcome.
Carter Lupton is the Curator Emeritus of Ancient History at the Milwaukee Public Museum. The museum's current visiting exhibit, Maya Hidden Worlds Revealed, was created by the Science Museum of Minnesota, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and the Museum of Science in Boston.
It's at the Public Museum through the end of May, and there is more information about it at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton explains how the Hubble Space Telescope has helped us see into the early universe. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about the current exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum that explores the world of the ancient Mayan civilizations of Central America. Among other things, the Maya were pretty good astronomers.
In the intervening centuries, things have only gotten better for scientists. Astronomers, in particular, have benefited from huge advances in technology that allow them to explore ever earlier into the history of the universe itself.
One of the key pieces of technology that has enabled that exploration is the Hubble Space Telescope. And for our astronomy segment this month, contributor Gene Creighton explains why she's featuring that in her current programming at the Manfred Olson Planetarium.
Lake Effect contributor Gene Creighton's day job is as the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Gene joins us each month to discuss all things astronomical.
So Hubble has been up for 28 years, and for some people, especially on campus, they don't know life without it, right? And I thought it might be fun to talk about the four most important contributions, I think, that the Hubble made. And I thought it would be fun to have a series of those kind of top hits of the Hubble?
I mean, to me, I mean, I remember certainly the time before the Hubble, as do you, and it was really revolutionary when it went into orbit.
It was. But I feel I ought to say here something that I think most people don't realize, that there are dozens of space telescopes in space. And furthermore, the first one went up in 1965. So these have been there. It's just that I think the Hubble made a real point, a real effort to connect to everybody, to make sure that in addition to the science, of course, that it does, that there was also an aesthetic value that anyone could perceive. The people who are footing the bill would be happy to pay the bills if they could see what came out of this instrument.
And why had that not been done before? I mean, as you say, the first one went up in 1965. There are other ones up there, certainly doing good science and getting back interesting data for us. What made NASA decide to make this sort of the people's telescope?
I think when they realized that they're vulnerable, their funding is vulnerable, and if people don't continue to want to support it, especially... You recall, of course, that Hubble had some difficulties at the beginning. The mirror hadn't been smooth enough, and therefore the images that came out originally were not as good as they ought to be. So there was some pushback, and people were starting to wonder, well, why are we spending money to do these projects, etc. So I think people at NASA realized, and the Space Institute, that we can't just take it for granted that people are going to want to support these projects. We need to make it somehow worth their while and bring them along.
Come along on the journey.
Yes, yeah. Come along. Explore with us.
All right. Well, we have been exploring for 28 years with the Hubble. And what is, for today's conversation, what is the one pillar? We have four pillars of kind of big knowledge that the Hubble has helped us understand better. What's the one we're talking about today?
We're going to talk about how we understand now better the past, present, and future of the universe and how it expands. So that's a
big topic.
Big topic, yeah. So we're going to cut it into little pieces, because what it requires to make that assessment is to be able to measure the rate of expansion of the universe at different distances from us, in other words, at different epochs. So what was the rate of expansion of the universe far and then farther still? Because that tells us what was the rate of expansion of the universe before and even before then. So far, so good.
Yeah, we're kind of figuring out the timeline as well as distance traveled over that timeline.
Right. So we're trying to isolate what is the rate of expansion of the universe at two different times. And before 20 years ago, we thought, I think somewhat naturally, that if you have some massive, let me call it an explosion, expansion, a sudden expansion of the universe, that our instinct said we presumably are running out of steam. So now we are expanding slower than we did in the past, or at best, we're cruising at the same speed.
Right. That initial explosion was huge, and then things kind of level out or slow down.
Right.
Okay.
So that was what we thought. And the thing that the Hubble Space Telescope could do for us was that it could measure distances more accurately for a certain class of object that we call a supernova. And most people have heard the term supernova. It's what happens when a massive star explodes. We know that's a beautiful thing, but what makes the explosion interesting scientifically is that at that peak moment where it's producing the most amount of light, it actually does it consistently throughout all the supernovae. There's a particular class of supernova that is what we call a standard candle. In other words, if one looks brighter than the other, then you can do some simple math and figure out how much closer the brighter one is from the other. We can also use the Hubble Space Telescope, like many of these instruments, to figure out the speed of said supernova. So the idea was that if you look at the rate of expansion of the universe and you measure that, because supernova that are reasonably far, the speed that you measure is not their speed moving through space, it is them piggybacking on space itself.
Oh, okay.
So they give you a flavor of how fast is the universe expanding at that time. The expectation was that the farther you look, the earlier the universe was, and therefore the speed ought to be faster than it is more recently.
Right.
That was the expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And we started finding, as I said, 20 years ago now, that in fact, the evidence was the opposite, that the rate more recently has been faster than it used to be.
So we're speeding up.
We are speeding up. The universe is accelerating in its expansion. And as you can imagine, at first people thought, okay, we've made a mistake somewhere. We need to look at this data again. There's some problem.
Redo our calculations.
Redo the calculations. Yep. And people redid the calculations. Other groups to verify did different kinds of observations. Now it's been confirmed to death. The universe is accelerating in its expansion. And, of course, you know where this is going. We don't know why that is. But it makes for spectacular science. I mean, that's the beautiful thing, right? We discover something unexpected, and then we have to go back to the drawing board to figure out, huh, we didn't expect this. Now let's figure out why this might be. We should acknowledge that this data was hard enough to get and to process and to understand that, you know, groups of people got a Nobel Prize for this work. And I strongly suspect that whoever figures out what the nature of what we call now dark energy is, we'll probably pick up another Nobel Prize. The idea is we don't know why the universe is accelerating in its expansion. Maybe it is the nature of gravity. Maybe it's the nature of space-time. Maybe there's something completely different. Maybe we need to tweak even Einstein's theory that works so well for us. We're not quite sure. People are working on it for sure. It's a very, very current, hot astronomical field of research.
Thanks to the Hubble.
Yeah, and it kind of brought that certainty that, you know, an idea that we held dear for so long, that surely the universe at most is cruising at the same speed, we had to reexamine it and come up with new and fascinating ways of solving this mystery.
And that's one of the things that I love about our conversations and about science in general, is that it's always ready to take on the unexpected and say, okay, we have to rethink how we perceive the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to, I mean, there's that human resistance to change and say, no, I believe this. But it's wonderful that we can kind of sit here and go, oh, okay, shift.
Right.
Let's rethink this.
Right.
And all new things, some of which we will never imagine in a gazillion years talking to each other, may come out of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I like the idea that, as you say, it takes a little time to shift. And there's good reason for that. You do want to make sure the data is solid, because it's easy to find a result that quickly you realize, oh, okay, I just made a mistake. That was not really true. But the fact that multiple people can reproduce the effect with different kinds of data, even different approaches entirely, builds confidence. And then you say, okay, I can't ignore this result anymore. I have to figure out why.
I have to incorporate it somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And who knows, as you say, maybe there'll be a new theory or at least a tweak.
That's right.
To Einstein's.
To what we understand. Yeah. So that alone, I think, is just a marvelous thought to have in February about all the information that we amass, that we process, that we try and figure out, and kind of become wiser about how it all works.
We'll take one last break, and then a Milwaukee musician thinks back on the songs that spark his memory in an essay we'll hear in just a moment. That's here on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Music and memory can have a powerful connection, like the songs that connect us to our childhood, or fond memories like a first dance, a wedding, or a graduation.
Milwaukee's Kieron Vedula has made a lot of his own music. He scored the episodes of our Precious Live segment for a couple of years, but then he started thinking about other musicians' songs that were important to his life, and he crafted an essay for February's Milwaukee Magazine. He shared that essay and its inspiration with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
So about 4 or 5 months ago, I wanted to find a way to kind of stay in touch. You know, I'm an independent artist, but I work with a lot of organizations and people, and I wanted a way of kind of keeping in touch with people without always having to constantly make meetings. So one of my, you know, a mentor of mine suggested I start a newsletter. So I started the MailChimp newsletter, and it was called Q the Sun, like C-U-E the Sun. But that's also my producer alias, Q the Sun with the letter Q. But the idea was to open up a discussion around music and relationships and community, and because that's centered around all the work that I do, and I've been thinking about it more over the past couple of years, just kind of getting a little bit burnt out from the more like basic things that come with being a musician, or that you would expect a musician to do, like, you know, performing, touring, recording, which I kind of did most of my 20s. And now I'm in my early 30s, and I've just kind of wanted more out of it. And in doing a lot of youth work over the years and kind of expanding that to a more community-minded for adults, too. So that's kind of been my focus, is like, you know, it's more to music than just songs. You know, the song is just the thing that the music happens around. So those are kind of the subjects that I've been discussing in different ways, whether I'm talking about, you know, Free Space or Grace Weber Music Lab or other things going around the city and COA. And so this happened to be, I wrote it for at the end of the year during Christmas time. I was like, oh, I may as well do a more personal one for the holiday season. And it was originally just a shorter version in the newsletter, and it had other things. But a lot of people really resonated with it in the same way that you did. You know, everyone got reminded of their own kind of songs and road trips and family members. And Carol Nixon is one of the people on my mailing list from Milwaukee Magazine. And she reached out saying, hey, I love it. I'd love you to expand it and have it in the magazine. So I was all for it, because I'm always looking for new ways of kind of challenging myself creatively. And writing has always been something I've been interested in, too. So I jumped right on it.
It sounds like at a really basic level, what you're doing is, as you say, it's, you know, about more than the song. It's about the connection that music makes between the musician and the people who listen to them.
Yeah, you know, I experience music most regularly through young people, whether they're in the audience at a show or my collaborators or students. And I think that, you know, there's this idea, you know, there's so much that comes with songs and artists and fashion and clothing and coolness and all these kind of things. But I realize that it doesn't really depend on, it doesn't matter what the songs are. You know, it's more so about what was happening at the time that you remember that song. So that's kind of what I was trying to touch on, is whether you're remembering your parents, or you're remembering your first high school girlfriend, or, you know, just remembering any moment in time that could have been good or bad. But when you, it's like smelling, you know, fresh grass or something like that. When you hear certain songs, you're just automatically time traveling back to such a specific, not only place, but just that entire moment in time for your, in a personal way.
Right, and when you're a musician, you're not just creating a song; you're creating the soundtrack of someone's life.
Absolutely.
It's really powerful stuff, and I think we should hear it. So, thank you so much for bringing it to us.
Thank you. The magic of music. It was the last warm day of the year. My parents and I had just spent the afternoon with relatives, walking around an arboretum near Naperville, enjoying the weather. Now we were in the car, returning to my folks' place in Racine. It had been a full day, and the conversation began to die down as we reached the Illinois-Wisconsin border. My mom was driving, as she typically prefers to. My dad was in the back seat, on the verge of one of his famous snaps. My dad is known as a super napper because he can fall asleep in any position for 2 minutes, then wake up fully rejuvenated. Traveling north on I-94, gazing at the pastel autumn sunset, I connected my phone to the car's Bluetooth and scrolled through my iTunes library to find something to play. Most of the music on my recent playlist didn't fit the mood, so I opened Apple Music and searched for songs that all three of us would enjoy. I started with Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, a family favorite. Seconds into the first verse, we were all singing along. That song evokes memories of road trips to my uncle's houses, where we'd play table tennis, hike through parks, and visit the college campuses where they worked. Back then, in the 80s, my parents and their siblings were still new to this country, having recently immigrated from India. They were in their 20s, and I was a little toddler, an only child. I think their new life in the United States must have been quite a culture shock, and at times very lonely. Fortunately, many of my uncles and aunts lived in the Midwest, so we were able to visit them often. We made a lot of great memories, and listening to music and singing along together was a big part of that. Fast Car was the first song on a mixtape that my mom's older brother made for us early on. We listened to that tape whenever we were in the car back then. The songs covered a wide range, from Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy, to Iron Butterfly's Inagata De Vida, to Carly Simon's You're So Vain, and Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong's Dancing Cheek to Cheek. That tape was our family's soundtrack. My next selection was Tin Man by America, then Happy to Be Stuck with You by Huey Lewis and the News. As the car's DJ, I fueled the nostalgic feelings with more songs from that old mixtape, plus some that my dad used to sing in the shower and at family get-togethers, like Harry Belafonte, Kishore Kumar, and the Eagles. I added a few songs I used to play on the piano and guitar during my teenage angst years, Ben Folds' Five's Evaporated, and Dave Matthews Band's Number 41. Those songs took me back to playing my first acoustic shows at Barnes & Noble and Cybergrounds Cafe, hanging out with my best friends in high school, and dealing with acne. As we took exit 329 Highway K, I glanced at my mom, who was looking out at the road with a subtle smile and a translucent glaze swelling over her eyes. "I wish this car ride didn't have to end," she said. My dad and I knew exactly what she was feeling. She was remembering my uncle's living room and me as a little kid. Those old road trips, me playing piano and singing in the evenings after dinner. She was remembering her younger self. And I'm sure when she thinks of those old times, she is amazed by how far she's come as a person and how far we've come as a family. In the chorus of Fast Car, Tracy Chapman sings, "I had a feeling that I belong. I had a feeling I could be someone." Those sentiments of connection and hope were reawakened that day in the car on the way from Naperville to Racine. The music transported us to an earlier time, and as we listened and sang together, a link in the family chain was added, a new memory and a feeling that is sure to stay with us for years to come.
Kieran Vadula performs as Cue the Sun. His essay on music and memory is in the February issue of Milwaukee Magazine. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect.
It's all right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.